Since everyone is here, we'll have Marshall call court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Clary, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is October 20, 2021. We're here for our second of six cases on our calendar this morning, A210709 Smith versus City of Crosby. Counsel, I'll ask that you mute your microphone when you are not speaking. The marshal will be showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to your time. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal at their option. I'll ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. With that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Pat Tierney. I'm with the law firm of Collins, Buckley, Santry, and Hauk. I represent the appellant, Jesse Smith, and he is with me here in the conference room today. This is an appeal of an order granting a summary judgment on two claims, on defamation claims and on claims under the Data Practices Act. First, on the defamation claim, the district court ruled that there were no issues of material fact on whether two sets of statements were false and defamatory. The first set of statements relate to statements made by Lieutenant Randolph concerning a meeting that he claimed took place about 11 days before a search warrant was executed on the mayor of the city of Crosby. Lieutenant Randolph claimed that a meeting took place that was attended by all of the Crosby.
Mr. Tierney, can I apologize for interrupting you so quickly in your argument, but I just wanted to clarify which allegedly defamatory statements that you were still pursuing on appeal. Because I noticed in, I think it's footnote 2 on page 28 of your brief, that there were some statements that you weren't pursuing because of a lack of evidence. Specifically, it's in the district court's conclusions of law in paragraphs 3 and 4. So it seems to me that the alleged defamatory statement, but tell me if I'm wrong here. So I just wanted to clarify what we're dealing with. So first, the March 2019 statements in the radio interview, KKIN, with Lieutenant Randolph. And then second, statements made in the fall of 2017 to the background investigator who was doing the backgrounding on your client for the Deerwood Police Department investigation. Is that, do I have that right or is that wrong? Because we need, you know, in analyzing this, we need to know what specifically are the alleged defamatory statements that we're dealing with.
Sure. The confusion, I think, came up in the district court's order on there were three radio broadcasts. We're only pursuing claims out of one of those broadcasts, the one that we briefed. The other two, we don't have the transcripts on. I can't identify what was said other than what we believe was said. So we're not pursuing the ones that we could not get a transcript of. We are pursuing the claim, and the one I'm currently talking about is the claim that Randolph told Turcott, the investigator, plus City of Crosby officers, that Jesse Smith had given the mayor advance warning of a search warrant. That is being pursued. That's the first claim I plan on talking about.
But you said, and that he said, they said to other officers, but I don't see anything in the record, your briefs, the district court decision about those statements to other officers. So I'm assuming that we're just dealing with allegations about statements made by, I don't know if it's Coughlin or Coughlin and Randolph to the background investigator to Turcotte. Is that right?
True. And Turcotte then tells the people at Deerwood, and Randolph then goes back to the city of Crosby and investigates the claim. So in that investigation, they learn.
Yeah, but that's not a statement that I see in your complaint anyplace. I just am trying to be really clear because it's important to our analysis here. So yeah. that might be a course of conduct, but it seems to me, I mean, is that right? It's the statement made to Turcotte in the fall of 2017 that you allege by Randolph and Coughlin or Coughlin. Is that, that's it, right? That's for the correct. Defamation. And I understand you've got the Data Praxis Act count.
And that's the publication, and that's the claim. It does
right.
go on
okay.
from there, but that's not part of my brief. It's not part of my argument today, how far that goes on. It's publication when it's made to Turcotte.
Understood. Okay, thank you so much. And again, sure. My apologies. Please go ahead.
Well, let me talk about that claim first. And the claim that Randolph told people that Officer Smith had given the mayor advance warning of a search warrant, because the district court found in finding number 24 that there was a meeting and this all happened. And the evidence doesn't support that. Randolph claimed that there was a meeting involving all of the officers at Crosby, during which he told all these officers that a search warrant would be served on the mayor. This meeting took place 11 days before the search warrant was served.
Didn't the district court reject that because the only evidence that your client provided in opposition to the motion for summary judgment was based on inadmissible hearsay? It was based on your own client's sworn statement saying, yeah, these officers told me that. Am I wrong there? And if so, why?
Well, I think you are wrong, Your Honor. It does come from the officers at Crosby. Those officers are employees of the city of Crosby. The information they learned was during the course of their employment. It's clearly not hearsay under the hearsay rules. That's an admission against interest. It's a statement of a party. It is not hearsay. I don't recall that being.
But do you have any case law to that effect, that just somebody who is an employee and not in a managerial or supervisory capacity, that's an admission against the city of Crosby?
I think the hearsay rule expressly states that, Your Honor. I don't have it in front of me, but it says if it's an employee of
where does it say that in the rule?
802, 801. I don't have my rule book in front of me, Your Honor. But it is in the hearsay rule.
I don't think that actually is in the language of the hearsay rule. But you're saying you don't have any case law to provide to us on that point today.
I do not have any case law.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Beyond that, the search warrant issued. It's also based on a claim. Randolph's claim that a call was made, and of course, Officer Smith denies all this, as did the Crosby officer, and there are no charges brought within Crosby. There's lots of facts as to why this meeting didn't take place, including the denial of Jesse Smith. But this tip-off allegedly occurred 11 days prior to the search warrant being executed. It's based on a phone call that Officer Ringland from the Crosby Police Department made to the Deerwood Police Department, not directly to Smith, made to Deerwood at a date when Smith is not working at the city of Deerwood. They claim then that Smith calls the mayor and gives him the information. Nobody other than Randolph says this happened, and Smith denies it. That seems to be an issue of fact in and of itself. Beyond that.
So which finding of fact, and then is that, and it doesn't it just have to be a substantial basis? I mean, you're talking about the actual malice issue, right?
Right now I'm talking about whether it's true or false. That is just no constitutional protection on that issue. It's just whether there's a material fact in dispute as to whether that fact is true or false. On the next step, the constitutional malice, I would need to meet a higher burden. But on the question of whether it's true or false, that is a no constitutional protection on that question. The other piece of evidence on this that the trial court relied on was Randolph claiming that a note summarizing this meeting, which did not take place, was found during the execution of the search warrant. The BCA agent,
Mr. Tierney, can I just ask you a question? I mean, even assuming that the statements were made, statements are false, the statements were made with actual malice, I'm having a hard time finding anything in the record substantiating any damages sustained by your client as a result of this alleged statement.
Well, there is. It's briefed. It's in our reply brief. We cite it.
What is the record evidence of his damages?
Okay. The record evidence is this. The answers to interrogatories, which were used in the summary judgment motion, and which I believe were also quoted in our brief. But his answers to interrogatories, he specifically stated that they tried to end his career as a police officer. It's been circulated through all of the police departments up in his area through the Cass County office that he engaged in conduct of tipping off the mayor on a search warrant. It's incredibly damaging to a police officer.
Tell me what the record evidence is of how that damage, that claim damage, has manifested itself. I mean, he applied for and received another job. It doesn't seem as though it has affected his career or that there's no tangible effect on his career. Is there some other evidence in the record that I'm just missing here?
You know, I'm going to strongly disagree with you, Your Honor. If you look at the Jigs in a defamation case, the damage is the emotional injury to the person defamed. Jesse Smith has lost countless nights of sleep because of this. It's been an emotional roller coaster. They tried to end his career every turn he took. They were there trying to bring him down again. It's been spread out to the law enforcement community up in his area that he's a crook and that he tipped off a person on a search warrant. That's incredibly damaging for a police officer. He does have a job at this time because they didn't believe.
And didn't he get promoted after all this came out? I mean, he was hired by Deerwood.
He hired by Deerwood. He's promoted.
And then Turcotte didn't pass on the information about the alleged tip-off. Isn't that right?
No, Turcotte did pass it along. Deerwood.
That's not what I saw in the record. He said he did not include it in his background.
He did not
investigation.
I'm sorry. He did not include it in the written report. He did tell Chief Mark Taylor about that accusation.
And then your client was hired and then he was promoted to a sergeant position, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So yes, he hasn't lost out-of-pocket money, but that is never the damages in a defamation case. And under the Data Practice Act, the statute is just as broad. He's entitled to recover any damages caused by the breach of the Data Practices Act. That includes the emotional injury that he suffered, which has been very substantial, which is in the record. It's in the answers to interrogatory. It's in our brief before the summary judgment. And it certainly was raised in our reply brief in this case, Your Honor.
So can I ask you a question now that on the Data Practices Act claim? Because part of that is you're talking about the letters to the editor from a council member, the attorney for the city, and a police clerk, I think. What is the private data in those letters? Because the Data Practices Act only deals with private data, and I see them talking about, that our police chief didn't lie. Nothing about Smith and any private data on Smith in those letters.
Here, under the Navarre v. Washington County decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, mental impressions of private data are private. They're governed by the Data Practices Act under the Navarre v. Washington County decision. Here, what our claim is that when the attorney who represented the city in the arbitration says that there are lies floating around in public and they cannot respond to them because Smith won't sign a waiver, and she believes he will never sign a waiver under these circumstances because he doesn't want it to come out. And then the council person who says, let's bring it on. Smith, sign a waiver so that we can show the public all this data. Those are mental impressions of the data. And under
what's the data then? I don't see anything about actual data. He was terminated. You know, I mean, that's where I'm having the problem with the letters.
Yeah, the data, this again, the letter to the editor from the attorney, Mary Lee Abrams, is the attorney who represented them in the disciplinary proceeding. The data would be the public, would be the private data on Smith that we claim should have been expunged. All his disciplinary actions, all the claims that he violated that supported their position in the arbitration, all of that data is private data. To the extent that they're expressing their views of that private data by telling Smith to bring it on, you won't sign a waiver. Abrams saying under these facts, you'll never sign that waiver. That's their mental impressions of what that data would show if it was produced. The data is the private data of the disciplinary actions against Smith that they presented at the arbitration proceeding.
All right, Mr. Tierney, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ms. Younger.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Anna Younger and I represent the respondents, Chief Kim Coughlin, Lieutenant Kevin Randolph, and the City of Crosby. Since we only have a limited time here, I'm just going to address a few points from the briefs. A large part of Mr. Tierney's argument today and his arguments in the brief regards the district court's factual findings and whether or not there is a genuine issue of material fact here. And there are some additional bits, I think we kind of got into them a little bit during Mr. Tierney's argument, indicating that the district court did make the correct decision. District court carefully reviewed the record and concluded that there were no issues of fact. The first one I'd like to discuss is that meeting with the Crosby officers. Mr. Smith can't cite any admissible evidence to that point that contradicts Randolph's sworn statement that that meeting occurred. If to the extent that an agent can make an admission on behalf of a principal, the statement must be made by the agent while the agent is acting within the scope of his authority and while engaged in the business of the principal. And that's from Rent-A-Scooter versus Universal Underwriters, 173 Northwest 2nd 9. There's no evidence in the record regarding the circumstances under which those statements were made to Smith.
Why aren't these non-hearsay statements? And I'm not talking about an admission by a party opponent, but I'm talking about a statement that's offered for a non-hearsay purpose, for notice. I mean, we're not talking about were the statements made for the truth of the matter asserted, the merits of the statement. We're talking about whether the statement was actually uttered. Yes or no? I mean,
I disagree, actually. I believe the statements are being offered for the truth of the matter asserted, because the fact that Smith is trying to allege is disputed here is whether or not Randolph held a meeting and told the Crosby officers about the search. Because Mr. Smith argues that if that meeting didn't happen, then Randolph couldn't have concluded that Smith is the one who might have told Hunter about the search warrant. So it is offered for the truth of the matter asserted. So it is hearsay. The next fact that I wanted to address is Mr. Smith's accusation that Lieutenant Randolph may have fabricated the handwritten note that was found by the BCA agents. Again, there's no evidence to support that in the record. BCA agent Pritzlaff's declarations did not say that he never found the note. His declaration said that he found sheets of purple paper with handwriting on them, but that he didn't remember this specific piece of paper, which isn't surprising years later. So that isn't evidence that the note didn't exist. Randolph received the boxes from the BCA, the boxes of evidence from the BCA, looked through the boxes and found a stack of purple paper that had all the same handwriting. There was no indication that the note was anything other than authentic. Finally, just a note about the arbitration. Mr. Smith relies on the arbitration and the arbitrator's award, the second award, to suggest that Randolph and Coughlin should have known that their statements about Smith were untrue, but especially the statements about whether or not he committed some criminal conduct. But obviously, an arbitration is not a criminal trial. It's an evaluation of whether Smith violated city policy and whether the discipline that was imposed was fair and equitable under the circumstances. It's undisputed here that he violated city policy. He admitted to that. He used Crosby computers to do non-Crosby work. So the real question then for the arbitrator was just whether the discipline termination was reasonable. And the arbitrator concluded that it wasn't, because there were other Crosby officers who had used their computers for personal reasons like checking their email, et cetera, and hadn't been disciplined. And so the arbitrator believed that Smith's discipline was unreasonable. The city saw a difference between those two. The city saw a difference between incidental checking of email and performing work for another agency while being paid by Crosby taxpayers. Essentially, from the city's perspective, they felt like they were involuntarily subsidizing Cuyuna's police department, because about half of the ICRs that Smith wrote during that time period, he wrote while on duty for Crosby.
Oh, Ms. Juncker, if I could interrupt. I mean, what do we do with the evidence that it seemed like they really were arguably on a vendetta against Mr. Smith? And how does that factor into kind of reckless disregard and the actual malice analysis?
Well, I disagree that the evidence shows that there was any sort of vendetta against Mr. Smith. They believed that he was not fit to continue to work in the Crosby Police Department. They believed that he did not have the skills or character to be a law enforcement officer. And so they terminated him from Crosby, and they told the background investigator about his conduct. I don't think that that leads to the conclusion that there was some sort of vendetta. They were acting.
But it's all the other stuff that they did that leads to the conclusion that they may have been acting with some sort of a vendetta. They're going on the radio program. There's this flurry of letters to the editor. I mean, this, we're talking about a small community and someone whose name has been highlighted in media for quite some time in a relentless way. So, I mean, how does that play into the analysis of whether these statements were made with actual malice?
Well, the letters to the editor, the flurry of letters to the editor that you mentioned, those were by a citizen in Deerwood who wrote a bunch of letters to the editor, mostly disagreeing with Crosby's decisions. There were only, I believe, three letters that were from anyone from the city, and those are the three that are in the record here. So over the course of several years, there were about, I think, over 75 articles in the local newspapers, including letters to the editor, on this topic. Only three of them were at all from the city's perspective. The city wasn't repeatedly filing letters to the editor attacking Mr. Smith. So discussing some of those defamation claims, for Mr. Smith to prevail, he needs to satisfy two standards. He needs to satisfy an objective standard and a subjective standard. The objective standard comes from Hunter versus Hartman. And in that case, the court held that a statement is protected by the First Amendment and thus not defamatory if it's a supportable interpretation of ambiguous underlying events. It's a reasonable person standard. A reasonable person could find that the statements are a supportable interpretation of the events. It's not defamatory. The subjective standard is the actual malice standard from New York Times versus Sullivan. So the district court order should be affirmed because Mr. Smith can't satisfy either one of those standards here. And I'll start by just discussing some of that group of statements that either he engaged in criminal conduct or was corrupt, kind of those groups of statements. He can't satisfy the objective standard there because there are facts supporting an interpretation that he engaged in criminal conduct on three different occasions. First is it's undisputed that he submitted overlapping timesheets to Crosby and Cuyuna and was paid by both entities. That's a violation of section 609.45 or 609.455, unauthorized compensation of a public official. The arbitrator didn't believe that was necessarily concerning because the arbitrator thought perhaps they were mistakes, but Randolph reached a different conclusion. And he did. He reached that conclusion based on Smith's Garrity statement during the internal affairs investigation. Smith said that he wrote those Cuyuna ICRs while he was on his breaks, but computer data later proved that none of them were written on his breaks. He wrote over 50 ICRs while he had entered into the LETG system that he was actually doing work for Crosby, like monitoring a stop sign or responding to a call or out on traffic patrol.
How, Ms. Juncker, when you're talking about officers out on patrol, how do you know when their breaks are? I mean, how do they, and only answer to the extent this is in the record, do they clock in, do they clock out? I mean, how do you know that?
They don't have breaks at all. And it is in the record. It is in...
Well, they do have breaks. I mean, they're exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act. I don't...
They're not unpaid breaks, though. They're paid.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
So because they're paid breaks, the city of Crosby is paying him during that time. And that was the city's concern, that they were paying him to perform work for another agency and paying, and not just incidental and ICR here and there. It was about half of the ICRs that he wrote for Cuyuna during that time period. He did on Crosby's time. So the fact that Smith entered that information into LETG that was inaccurate, saying that he was responding to a call or et cetera when he was actually writing Cuyuna ICRs, is significant for a couple reasons. The computer data conclusively proves that he entered false information into LETG. Creating an official government record with knowledge that it's false is a crime that violates 609.43 Part 4. And then those false records, coupled with Smith's false statement that he wrote all the ICRs during his breaks, indicated to Randolph that he knew his behavior was wrong and he was taking steps to conceal it. So those are the first.
Counsel, I appreciate these arguments. I think we're familiar with the record. I have a few questions that I want to ask you about the data practices claim, if I may.
Of course.
So I appreciate the undisputed fact that Mr. Smith, or Officer Smith, voluntarily disclosed the actual arbitration award, that information. Mr. Tierney makes an argument this morning that's a little bit different, and that is that there are city officials who disclosed information that they, or impressions that they may have learned during the course of their investigation, that are also private. So that would be something that was not disclosed voluntarily by the officer, but was something extra that was disclosed by the city. Why isn't that a colorable data practices claim?
Well, first of all, I don't believe it actually is new information. The arbitration award itself is incredibly detailed. It lists the city's positions and arguments in great detail. The arbeitrator
Yes. Can I interrupt? Mm-hmm. So I know this is actually that Lieutenant Randolph, you know, in the transcript of that radio program said, well, because he distributed, the arbitration award, then, and you've argued this, that then that waives the obligation that it's no longer private data. But what do you base that on? I mean, is there any case law? Because the employer still is not allowed to release private data without consent. I mean, the individual can release data on themselves, but it's what do you base your argument that because the individual released their own private data, that suddenly the employer is released from the obligation to maintain the data as private data?
Sure. Well, the answer to that question is that in order to prove a data practices claim, a party has to show both that there was an unauthorized disclosure of data and also that they suffered damage as a result of that unauthorized disclosure. That's an essential element of a data practices claim. And here, because Smith released all of the data himself and waived his right to keep it private, there's no way to argue that the city repeating the exact same information that he'd already released could somehow cause him damage. They hadn't released anything new. And to Judge Frisch's point before, those mental impressions, that was not new information. The city's position was laid out in detail in the arbitration award. And so nothing in those letters was new information. More importantly, it's not information on an individual, which is required for a violation of the Data Practices Act.
So would you agree that if the city released information that it learned in the investigation, that is not necessarily included in the 52-page report, that would be private data that the city would be prohibited from disclosing?
I don't know that I'd go quite that far, because I don't know that I have a perfect enough memory of the record. But I would agree that if the city released any data that hadn't been released by the plaintiff already, yes, that could have provided a basis for a data practices claim, but he would still need to show damage based on the city's disclosure. And I don't think that that can be done in this case because the information is a repeat of what had already been said.
And if it's not a repeat, then it would be private data. And
if it hadn't been released by Smith already, yes.
Presumably. Because I'm going to ask Mr. Tierney in about 58 seconds what additional data was disclosed by the city that was not included in that report.
Right. So the other point that I just wanted to make quickly is that it has to be data released on an individual. And the Minnesota rule, administrative rules explain what that means, how you identify a person in data. It's got to be a name or an address or a job position, something that is unique to a single individual. You have to be able to identify the individual from the data or from what was released. And that's not possible here because the statements in the letters were vague statements about the city didn't lie or the city had been accused by that resident of Deerwood of lying about a number of things, not just this. There was a series of letters attacking the city for a number of things. So for the city just saying we didn't lie, there's no way to say that even referred to Smith because it's not individually identifiable that he is somehow the subject of that data. So I see that I'm out of time. So unless the court has any specific questions, that's all I have for you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Junker. Mr. Tierney, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you could, sir, if you would begin by identifying any additional private data that was disclosed beyond the 52-page report, that would be helpful. Thank you, sir. You're muted. There you go.
My screen flicked around. Here is our claim on that, Your Honor. What is released is mental impressions of the data that has not been released. The easiest way to do this is to look at what Council Member Paul Hegelin said. In his letter to the editor, he says, they're prohibited from responding to the stuff that's out there in the press unless this signs a waiver. He says, quote—
well, isn't that just a restatement of the law, though?
That is.
I'll let you finish.
Then he says, quote, bring it on, get the waiver, and we will lay it all out. So what they're telling the public, and this is what Mary Lee Abrams says as well, what they're telling the public is that the arbitration award that's out there is wrong. We have all the data that will prove that the arbitration award is wrong. Bring it on, get the waiver, we will lay it all out there.
Okay, so the challenge that I'm having, Mr. Tierney, is that's sort of a statement that we have additional data, but it's not a release of data. So what about that statement is violative of Chapter 13 of the Minnesota statutes?
It's their mental impression of the data that they cannot release, and that is private data under the Navarri decision. Their mental impressions of the data that cannot be released is that data would show the arbitration award was wrong. So sign your waiver, Smith, bring it on, we'll put it all out there. It's their mental impressions of the private data, the investigative data, all the data that they're prohibited from releasing. That's our claim on that. And then on your damage question, Your Honor, we do lay the damages out, page 15 of our reply brief. It quotes from the answers to interrogatories on what the damage claim is here. We're not claiming out-of-pocket kind of damages, wage loss. We understand he got a job at Deerwood. Deerwood appreciates him. They disagree with Crosby. They think he does a good job. They did promote him. But he has suffered extensive damages as a result of this. And that community up there to be labeled a corrupt criminal crook who tipped off the neighbor in his community, that's devastating damages. It has cost him sleep, and he lays that all out, and it's on page 15 of our.
But Mr. Tierney, okay, so focusing in on the Data Practices Act, now you're back to the Turcotte communications, correct? And because that's the tip off, that the letter to the editor, the arbitration didn't deal with the tip off, the alleged tip off, and so. Your client signed not one, but two releases of the Data Practices Act. So why isn't that the answer to whether or not there was a violation of the Data Practices Act? And the release said, you know, anything that might be relevant you know, to being hired as a police officer right. is released.
Yeah, the release has nothing to do with the statements that are being made in the press. He did not release them to go out to the and talk to the media about this. The release.
But where did they talk to the media about the alleged tip off? Where is I don't see that in a release to the media. Sorry. That's what I was talking about was the Turcotte communication that those, you know, that those communications.
The tip off is not a private, is not a Data Practices Act thing. There's nothing about the tip off in his personnel file. He's working at Deerwood at that time. He doesn't. The tip off is something that is not part of his personnel file.
Sorry. Yep, you're right. It's a long, confusing record. I'm sorry. It's only the defamation claim.
That's the defamation claim. Yep.
So you're not claiming. So is it just the media communications then that you're saying violated the Data Practices Act, not anything in the communications in the meeting with Turcotte?
No, we are claiming in the meeting with Turcotte, what he signed, the authorization that Smith signed.
Oh, that's what I thought. Okay.
Both of them, they both say that I'm releasing data as defined by the Data Practices Act, Section 12 of that.
It's right. So that's said, private data,
that's
right?
Physical. Yep. That's the physical data. You're not.
Well, based on what?
The definition.
You're talking about mental impressions are private data.
Under case law, mental impressions are private. Private data. Yes. The release.
So why do you say that only physical data is data?
Because I'm saying that's what he released by signing the consent form. He did not consent to them having conversations with Turcotte. He released to the release of the file, the data, then they could pay the reproduction cost.
Okay, so that's something that's for us, well, for the district court, and then for us to review what's in the release and analyze.
And the release is very specific. It says it's releasing it. It's a data practices release. It's releasing it under Section 12 of the data practice definition section. It's referring to the hard data. It does but
then,
not.
So then I'm going to ask you real quickly again that in the meetings with Turcotte, but you're not complaining about the alleged tip off. Any discussions of that? Is that right?
There should have been.
I thought that's what you said.
In the defamation context, we complain of that in the data practices. There should be nothing about that in his personnel.
Okay, so you're not complaining about that communication in the, if there was one in the communications with Turcotte.
Not
is
as
that
a data,
right?
Not as a data practice violation. As
okay,
a
all right. Thanks so much for helping clear this up. It obviously was a really big record here with, I don't know, 3 or 4 volumes worth of exhibits. So thank you.
I'm out of time.
You are, sir. Judge Cleary, did you have a question? You're muted.
Who's answered?
All right. Very good. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is now submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statute.